the garden.
Is the Brexit deal all but dead? I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Of course, no deal will bring challenges. I have been open about that today, as I have been in the past. It's not my preferred outcome, nor the government's. We want a good deal. But whatever challenges no deal may create in the short term, and they are significant, these can and will be overcome.
In what has been another tumultuous week for British politics, Michael Gove presented his No Deal Readiness Report, and an unnamed Number 10 source broke protocol by revealing some details of a diplomatic phone call between Boris Johnson and Angela Merkel. Brexit talks came to a screeching halt in Brussels, and for only the fifth time in the last 80 years, it was announced that Parliament will meet for a special sitting on a Saturday, 2 days after the EU summit where the Prime Minister will seek a deal. On that sitting, he will either ask MPs to vote on a deal agreed with the EU or discuss options for another way forward. With exactly 3 weeks left until the supposed Brexit date and relations between the UK and EU colder than ever, will Johnson be forced to ask for an extension? And are we heading for a snap general election sometime before Christmas? Also this week, Peter Walker talks to MPs on both sides of the Extinction Rebellion debate after Boris Johnson called the climate crisis activists uncooperative crusties. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, Boris Johnson went into this week hoping he could sweet talk a deal out of some of his proposed plan's most fervent sceptics in Europe. The negotiations stalled, however, when an unnamed source from Number 10 told journalists that a deal was essentially impossible after a call with German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
In any case, the EU will remain calm, vigilant, respectful and constructive. I think the deal is possible and very difficult, but possible.
The story angered many from both in Parliament and in Europe, and if a deal wasn't already dead in the water, this stunt by the anonymous source may well have been a final nail in the coffin. Now, can the government salvage a deal? Does it even want to? And has Europe run out of patience with the UK? To discuss all of this, I'm joined by The Guardian's Jennifer Rankin in Brussels, the political sociologist at the University of Bristol, Paula Surridge, and Anand Menon, director of UK in a Changing Europe. So, Jennifer, tell us, what is the mood like about Brexit in Brussels at the minute?
The mood is very gloomy, very pessimistic. But the outcome of the briefings on Tuesday, which again really soured the mood, I mean, they didn't really change the fundamental picture that people have been sceptical for many weeks now that any kind of agreement was possible in October. Ever since Boris Johnson wrote a letter to Donald Tusk in August, where he effectively resiled on the commitments made by Theresa May in order to have alignment with EU law if there were no agreement on the Irish border, ever since then, everyone in Brussels has been deeply pessimistic about any possible deal. So I think the breakdown that we've seen this week has been a story long foretold.
And commentators around Europe were less than impressed with how the UK government conducted itself and were calling it out of control. But you're saying that the damage from that wasn't irreparable. It's more of a sort of wider discontent with Boris Johnson's approach.
I think there is a wider discontent and people in the EU just see the briefings on Tuesday as part of a bigger picture. There was real sort of frustration, irritation, anger with these unsourced briefings. They were seen as childish, immature. People were just stunned by the readouts that a Number 10 source provided on the call with Angela Merkel and Boris Johnson. And she was saying things that any kind of Merkel watcher found just incredible, that the very cautious German Chancellor, who she's very careful with her words, and to hear her saying things like never ever and these sort of rather dramatic statements she was meant to have said, I mean, people were just incredulous about that, and they felt Number 10 was misrepresenting the call for their own purpose and that the Number 10 spin machine had really got out of control. So there's a hope that maybe they can put this to one side and get an agreement, but the prospects of getting that agreement in October look incredibly small, and I think most people have, if not in public, but in private, have given up on any kind of agreement at the EU summit next week.
And it even got Donald Tusk, that is, the president of the European Council, and it was a pretty extraordinary outburst by him, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, not his first, it has to be said. He gets quite emotional about these things, but I think, you know, these things spiral. That's the problem, is bad behaviour by one side is often mirrored by sort of intemperate language on the other. I do find myself wondering how many heads of state and government in the European Union will be willing to have phone calls with Boris Johnson if they assume that it's going to be leaked, and perhaps leaked inaccurately. Their incentive for doing so will go down, I'd have thought.
And the Irish Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and Boris Johnson are meeting sometime today in Liverpool with this sort of very slim chance that they might be able to thrash out some sort of bilateral deal between them. I mean, it is the case that no deal doesn't really suit Boris Johnson, isn't it, Paula, in terms of an election?
I'd say it's unclear whether it suits him or not, really. On one side of his party, he's got the Brexit Party snapping at his heels. And actually, some of the evidence suggests that a no deal might help to quash some of that. But of course, he's also got the Lib Dems snapping at the other side of his party, trying to take off those that are perhaps either remain supporting or in favour of a softer deal. So it's very difficult to know exactly how that would play out, whether the gains from the Brexit Party electorally would be more or less than the losses to the Lib Dems.
They can't make a bilateral deal.
Yeah.
Even if the Irish are willing to soften their position on the backstop, there are things in the Boris Johnson plan that are in breach of EU law. You know, the VAT arrangement. We won't be in your VAT regime, but we'll figure it out nearer the day. Isn't going to fly with the EU. The Union's customs code is going to be flouted by this. They won't buy that. And the notion, it seems to me, that the EU would be happy to let the UK authorities act as the regulatory check on their external border strikes me as fanciful. So even if Leo Varadkar turns up in Liverpool and says, actually, Mr. Johnson, I've had a rethink, let's have a time-limited backstop, there are all sorts of details in the heart of this deal that I think the EU itself is going to struggle with regardless.
So talks seem to be at a standstill for the moment. Paula, how do you think that public opinion might be affected by this, with Boris Johnson taking a very aggressive stance in the negotiations and trying to paint Europe as to blame for the lack of reaching an agreement? Well, will that be beneficial to him in an election, or could it play against him?
Again, I think it comes down to that we don't really know how the public are going to respond to this. I've been asked questions before about, you know, what point in the negotiations did the public change their minds? The public as a whole are not paying that closer attention to what's going on. And until we actually get to a point where somebody can say something with some kind of certainty, I don't think we're going to see the kind of reactions in polling and amongst the public that everybody's looking for. I think the kind of wobbly polls reflect the fact that the public are very uncertain about what's going to happen next. There's a lot of undecided voters, a lot of floating voters. And until we've actually got something that looks more certain, I don't think we can really be sure.
And do you think voters care over here how Europe sees Boris Johnson's behaviour?
Yes, but in polar opposite ways. I think, you know, that splits both ways. I think there are some voters who are pleased to see him, as they would put it, standing up to Boris Johnson. We had that whole leave.eu tweet about Krauts and World Cups this week that some people loved and some people hated. And that sort of sums up the division in a way, that some people are appalled, some people like it. What I would say is, I suspect, I don't know what Paula thinks about this, we'll be a lot clearer about where public opinion is going once we've asked for the extension and we're in after the 31st of October, because at the equivalent point at the end of March, I mean, from the decision to delay, you see a fall off in Tory support and a rise in Brexit Party support, and that's going to be one of the key indicators as to what happens electorally.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I don't think until we know where we are at that point that we can really see what's going to happen. And also in terms of actually having an election called, you know, the public have kind of been told there was going to be an election, and so far we're not even in an election campaign. And we saw in the last campaign big changes in that kind of public opinion polling, and we could see that again. It's a very, very volatile situation.
So talking about extension, if the UK is running out of time to realistically get a deal by October the 31st, what is going to happen after that point? Now, the Prime Minister seems to be thinking ahead and he's making preparations to summon MPs for a special Saturday sitting of Parliament, which will be 2 days after the crunch European summit, where it becomes clear whether he's got a deal or not. Jennifer, is there any chance at all that European countries are going to veto the UK getting a Brexit extension at this stage?
it's very, very unlikely. I think what we will hear over the next week is an increasing chorus of EU leaders will start to say, well, there could be an extension, but there has to be a reason for it, such as an election, or, you know, we have a real plan from the UK. So I think they will grant an extension, but the debate for the EU is for how long should it be? What do they go with, a short 3-month extension as laid out in the BEN Act, which would take you to the end of January? Do they offer something longer in the hope that maybe the British political constitutional crisis can work itself out into some kind of outcome on Brexit? That will be very hard to predict until we actually get to the EU summit, if it's really obvious by then that extension is on the cards, or maybe even later in October. But at the moment, there are various ideas circulating that maybe you have it until the middle of June next year. That's been suggested for some time now, because it's the moment when the EU is expected to take a decision on its next 7-year budget. So there's quite a sort of natural cutoff point there, and also you don't want the UK potentially causing trouble. But then there are other people who leaned towards a shorter extension in order not to sort of prolong the agony of Brexit for the EU, which is just seen as one massive time-consuming headache. So this is the debate to come, really, but I don't see any EU country vetoing that extension.
There are a whole load of other considerations floating around as well. 3 months doesn't give us time to have a referendum. I suspect that's why January the 31st is in the BEN Act, because that was the only way they could get a majority, because there are people who want to delay who don't want a referendum. But if there are people in the European Union who'd like to see us have a referendum, we need 6 months minimum to do that. So that's a consideration. The other consideration, which I've heard people in other European capitals starting to talk about, is they're trying to game the impact of what they will do on a general election. Now, it strikes me that, firstly, that's a bit of a mug's game, because there's so much uncertainty about. But one of the considerations is, if we're seen to impose a long extension on the UK, say we give them till June, it feeds a line to Boris Johnson, which is, told you, they're trying to trap us in forever. So I think there'll be all sorts of considerations in the air when these people meet, and ultimately, as Jennifer said, we won't know until they're in the room together and are starting to talk.
If you just think about the mechanics of an election and a 3-month extension, we're not even in an election campaign yet. That's then got to be roughly 6 weeks. So that's taking us fairly close to that deadline already. As I said, everything is very volatile, but at the moment, I wouldn't put money on anything other than a hung parliament coming out of the mess of the polling. So then you've got another period where somebody's got to negotiate a government that again then going to negotiate. So the 31st of January just looks awfully close to me for all that to happen. And then you are just going to be into a position where somebody has to ask for another extension, potentially. So I would have thought that if you're looking at trying to resolve the situation through an election, you need a slightly longer extension to do that.
And we're talking about this extension like it's going to happen, but the government's official communications say that we're going to leave the EU on October the 31st, deal or no deal. Does anybody actually believe here that Number 10 have got something secret up their sleeves that can override the BEN Act?
That wasn't what their evidence to the Scottish court said. So, again, as in so many things, the government is giving out two parallel and very different messages.
There have been some really bonkers ideas doing the rounds as well about how the government might frustrate the BEN Act. I mean, Dominic Raab talked vaguely about even using Article 50 to override the BEN Act, which is really just a legal nonsense. So I don't think there's any obvious way for the government to frustrate the BEN Act, and that's clearly not what they've told the courts either. So I think everyone's money is on them having to ask for an extension.
OK, we shall leave it there on Brexit for now. Later on in the show, we're all going to be discussing the potential for a snap general election. We will be right back.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together we can fight for a better one. Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Taking a break from Brexit for a second, the Extinction Rebellion group has been protesting this week in London, blocking bridges and roads, with many getting arrested for their efforts. Some have voiced discontent at the disruption caused by the protests, including the Prime Minister, who simply dismissed them as uncooperative crusties who should leave the streets of the capital alone, clearing away their heaving, hemp-smelling bivouacs. Even that comment saw an unusual twist when one of the crusties ended up being Johnson's dad, Stanley.
On the point of cooperative, non-cooperative crusties, I wear that badge with pride. It's one of the nicest things which I've been said about me for a long time. A non-cooperative crusty. Absolutely superb. Do they taste good? That's my thought.
But do MPs feel the climate change activists are simply exercising their right to protest, or do they think they're going too far? The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker talked to two MPs on either side of the argument.
Extinction Rebellion have kind of taken over several bits of London as part of the protest, and a certain amount of it's been outside Westminster too. So they've been in Parliament Square, they blocked Lambeth Bridge for a bit, Westminster Bridge. Trafalgar Square is the main part, and today they blocked City Airport. But basically they've been trying to move around as fast as they can, so as the police unblock one part of the city, they then kind of move into another. The police response has been a lot more robust than the last time. I think the last time the police were kind of taken by surprise a little bit as to how easily a relatively small group of people could shut down large parts of London for, you know, a reasonable number of days. And this time they've very, very much gone in with the orders to try and clear things as quickly as possible. I happened by chance to be cycling over Lambeth Bridge, one of the central London bridges, on the day that the first Extinction Rebellion people actually tried to sit down. And immediately there were police picking them up and trying to drag them off. But it's very, very much been this kind of proactive thing. The police have arrested hundreds and hundreds of people. The total is going up every single day. It was about 500 last time I looked. And one of my colleagues at the Trafalgar Square site was basically saying that at one point yesterday, the police stopped arresting any more people because there was simply nowhere to put them. The MPs I spoke to, it seems to be quite split on party lines. The Conservative MPs are very, very much against this. Even though the Conservatives are trying to be much more green, they're basically saying this is the wrong way to do it, you're impacting ordinary people's lives and things like that. Whereas Labour have a much more kind of positive approach to it. I went to see Jeremy Corbyn make a speech just earlier, and he was asked about the protests afterwards, and he basically said, you know, there's a very kind of long tradition in Britain of these kind of non-violent protests. And he was making the point that in the past, you know, like the people, you know, who are campaigning for women's votes, ended up on kind of, you know, stamps and things like that. I'm not sure if he's saying Extinction Rebellion will be commemorated on postage stamps in the future, but it is possible. One of the MPs I spoke to was Ben Bradley, who is a relatively new and quite young Conservative MP. And even though he's relatively young and would seem to be on the kind of slightly more modernising wing of the party in certain ways, he was very, very much against it all. He basically says,
I think we have to be quite robust with it. I'm all for everybody's right to protest and to raise the point, but we can't get to a point, as is starting to happen here, where, you know, there are people saying we will decide which emergency vehicles are allowed to get through. You can't appoint yourself as the decider of people's life and death like that. That's absolutely wrong. So I do think we need to reach a point where we find a balance that might be a little bit more robust than where we are now.
I also spoke to Clive Lewis, who's a junior shadow minister, and he actually had wanted to give a speech to one of the Extinction Rebellion sites. He'd been stopped from doing it. But he's basically very keen. He takes the kind of Jeremy Corbyn approach.
Well, one of the things that becomes really clear is that there is such an impediment to having real meaningful, transformative politics and policies on this issue, which is an existential threat, that I think you need that public pressure, that public reminder that this is a serious issue. And at the moment, you know, the political establishment, for want of a better word, has taken its eye off the ball on everything else except for Brexit. So I think it's really important that they carry on pushing. Now, I understand, I think a lot of people out there understand, I get inconvenienced by what they do. I understand what it is they're campaigning about. They're campaigning about an existential threat that will potentially end life on the planet or civilization on the planet, not just for us, but perhaps our children as well. I think they're doing the right thing.
If you look at this whole issue kind of in the round, I don't think there's a lot of call from MPs for a change to protest laws. I mean, particularly around Westminster, around Parliament, the police have got a lot of powers to move people on. And, you know, if you speak to the police, the issue hasn't really been they haven't had the powers. It's just the sheer volume of people, each person who is kind of passively resisting had to be picked up, put in a police van, taken to the cells. So each person takes about 15 or 20 minutes to move. And that takes a very, very long time. And in terms of the kind of other parties, their kind of view on the Extinction Rebellion protest seems to vary slightly on how seriously they take the climate crisis. So the Liberal Democrats, and particularly the Greens, obviously, are much more pro this kind of thing. It's mainly just the Conservative MPs who are really, really worried.
Thanks for that, Peter. Now, the Prime Minister has asked several times already this autumn if Labour will back him in having a general election. But so far, Jeremy Corbyn has refused to give him one because it's not certain that no deal Brexit is off the table. But Labour has promised to vote for one as soon as that possibility has been removed. Paula, when is your best guess about when there will be an election?
No pressure, Paula.
Nice, easy question.
Just the date, that's all we want.
Just the date. The date that I've seen people saying is most likely is around about the 5th of December. And certainly the stuff that we were seeing yesterday in the papers about what Corbyn may or may not have said suggested that late November, early December was certainly a possibility. But there are all sorts of reasons for not having elections in December. And so I still think that's a little bit uncertain.
Labour politicians certainly say to me that they feel like their voters don't come out when the weather's not that great. Is that a bit of an antiquated view of Labour voters?
Perhaps a little bit. I mean, obviously we get a much bigger postal vote these days than we ever used to. So that might be a really big factor, actually. And that's an important factor to think about in this election. If lots of people use a postal vote because they're worried about snow and rain and dark nights, then decisions will be made much earlier in the campaign than they would be in a summer election. So it might be a slightly antiquated view, but certainly a consideration about people going out to the polling station when it's dark.
And how much of a Brexit election do you think this is going to be?
No clue. I mean, you know, I expected 2017 to be a Brexit election, and it really wasn't, certainly not to the extent that the Prime Minister wanted. And one of the key things for Labour is going to be the extent to which they can pivot and start talking about other stuff. And it's very, very hard to know because we don't know the circumstances in which it's happening. We don't know how prominent Nigel Farage and Joe Swinson will be on the campaign trail. They will obviously want to talk about nothing but Brexit and will keep dragging it back to that. So I think that's one of the variables, and I wouldn't like to hazard a guess, to be honest, about how much it dominates the campaign.
And as a speech in Northampton today, Jeremy Corbyn is saying that Labour are champing at the bit to go to the polls. Do you think that's a sensible position for them, Paula?
If they've got some polling different to the public polling, perhaps, but certainly based on the public polling that we've seen, it doesn't seem like a particularly sensible position. They don't look in a strong position to gain voters over 2017. They look like they're going to lose voters over 2017, and they weren't in government after 2017.
I mean, Jeremy Corbyn might be champing it with a bit, but there are plenty in his parliamentary party who really are not.
Some in Labour, though, particularly around the Labour leadership, believe that actually, Brexit hasn't really destroyed the long-held view of politics being a sort of a left and right game after all. And actually, voters will come back and vote on policy rather than their strongly held leave or remain positions. Do you think that's right?
You've just rephrased the question I didn't know the answer to a minute ago, so I have to say I don't know again. but that's just one of the big unknowns, isn't it? The degree to which Brexit frames this election is going to be fundamental. I mean, just take the South West, okay? So in the South West, you have a bit of a Lib Dem renaissance going on. At the same time, the South West is an area that voted strongly to leave. So it seems to me that the framing and the narrative around this election is going to be absolutely fundamental to what happens there. If this becomes a Brexit election, I'd expect a slightly different outcome than if it became a more normal election. And I'm afraid I just don't know which it will be.
It will probably be a mix of both.
Yeah.
Clearly, three of the four parties in England are going to want that focus to be on Brexit primarily. And so that mitigates against Labour's voice being able to chip in at that and make it about other issues. But there are about half of the electorate who give something else as the issue that's most important to them. So for those voters, they're probably looking for something else that speaks to those concerns. And so I think, much like in 2017, you'll have the clash of the two. And I think this is what, at the moment, the parties don't seem to understand. I saw a piece yesterday saying, you know, some of the parties want it to be all about Brexit, some of the parties want it to be all about the old left-right, but the voters are positioned on both of those things, which produces quite interesting different groups of voters, and it's really difficult to predict which way they will go, depending on what's really important to them on the day.
And if this election takes place, supposing there's some kind of deal within the next week or so, where do the Brexit Party and Lib Dems fit into all of this? Do they sort of go away as a threat to the two main parties, and do we go back to a kind of polarised Conservatives versus Labour that we had in 2017, Paula?
I don't think we're going back to that anytime soon. The Lib Dems will continue, if not with quite such a high share, but they'll be the home for the rejoiners, and that will be a significant chunk of those very, very strong Remain identifiers, I suspect. And I used to think a few days ago that actually a deal might kind of kill off the Brexit Party, or a no deal might kill off the Brexit Party. And actually now I think any outcome actually increases their presence as well. So obviously not leaving pushes the Brexit Party up really high instantly. But a deal will always not quite be the Brexit that they wanted, so that's easy to portray. And a no deal, if, you know, even a small percentage of the consequences of no deal that we're being told might happen, then the Brexit Party have got the line, but you didn't do it properly, you didn't prepare properly. So I don't think it matters where we go. I think the Brexit Party have got a place to keep attracting voters.
Anna, do you think there is the potential for some anti-European sentiment in this upcoming election from both the Brexit Party and the Conservatives, and a sort of nationalist direction to all of this?
Well, yeah, I don't think it's potential. I think it's real. I think we're living it now. I mentioned the Leave.eu tweet about Germans. I mean, the language has become incredibly intemperate. I mean, the language has become intemperate on both sides, to be fair. So, yes, I mean, there is a real danger that that kind of nationalist rhetoric will be ramped up in an election, because it is one of the ways in which the Conservative Party might seek to drag voters back from Nigel Farage.
How do Labour deal with that?
Well, I think Labour's strategy will be to talk about everything but Brexit, ultimately. I don't think that Labour are going to go out and say, you know, hurrah for Europe, because they have the problem with Leave voting Labour supporters. But I think Labour just will try and just hammer out a message that while the Tories are tearing themselves apart over Europe, we want to fix hospitals and austerity. And then the question, as Paula pointed out a minute ago, is the degree to which they get cut through with that.
And Jennifer, just coming back to you in Brussels, does Europe actually want another Prime Minister other than Boris Johnson to negotiate with? Or do you think they want to get Brexit just over and done with as quickly as possible and they don't mind who's at the helm?
They certainly want to get Brexit over and done with. For the EU, it's always a case of you deal with the Prime Minister who arrives in Brussels, and that's just how it works. It's a very sort of intergovernmental system right at the top, of personal connections between EU leaders. And I think it's pretty obvious that Boris Johnson is not on the Christmas card list of Donald Tusk or Emmanuel Macron when it comes to personal friendships. But nonetheless, he is the Prime Minister they have to deal with, and they would deal with any other Prime Minister. So I don't think it's just something they wouldn't want to get involved in, whether there should be a new Prime Minister or not.
You don't think they're pining for Jeremy Corbyn and the possibility of a customs union?
No, I mean, I read sometimes it in both directions, you know, EU worried about Corbyn coming in, or EU really hoping it will be Corbyn. And it's just not what I pick up here. I think really genuinely people are much more neutral, much more open, but overwhelmingly people want Brexit to be done. And I also think that there's a bit of a misperception that you often hear in among sort of MPs at Westminster that, oh, actually the EU are just trying to keep us in. They really don't want us to leave. I mean, I hear an awful lot of sentiment of people just saying, no, we really want to get this over with. We really think it's better for everyone if Brexit happens. But then again, of course, as we all know, if and when Brexit does happen, it's not the end. It's only the beginning of the next phase of the trade negotiations and everything else. But possibly then, if Brexit has happened, that draws a line and everyone can move on. I think that would certainly be the hope that people would have here.
I agree on the sort of personal relations, and, you know, there isn't a Jeremy Corbyn fan club necessarily in Brussels, but Boris Johnson's proposals have profound economic implications, because we've been focused a lot on the Northern Ireland dimension, but actually the point of Boris Johnson's Brexit proposal is to allow us to have a far looser relationship with the European Union, even than the one that Theresa May wanted. And all the indications are Boris Johnson's deal will have a significantly greater negative impact on the economy here and in the member states most affected by Brexit than would Theresa May's deal, let alone the far softer sort of Brexit that the Labour Party seems to be after. So in that regard, at least, a Brexit that will cause the least amount of economic pain would militate in favour of rather hankering after someone else to talk to.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all of our guests, Jennifer Rankin, Paula Surridge, Anand Menon and Peter Walker. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.